Good evening, everyone. It's Wednesday night, and we've actually moved on to chapter 12. We've been on chapter 11. We're on it for a couple of weeks. Chapter 12 is going to take us a while to get to. It's a hearty meal, and as it was described on one of the many emails back and forth between everybody trying to get a handle on this, Harry described it, Tianja described it, it says, although we can probably agree that this chapter is extremely dense in subject matter, content, and possessed of almost Hegelian complexity.
Yeah, right.
So we're going to do that. But it's going to be worth the effort. It's going to be worth the stretch to us to take the time to begin to absorb some of the concepts of what is meant by an octave. The name of the chapter is octave. We've moved from the statement in chapter 11 of the prayer absolute, and now we're going to actually unpack it a bit, Ivan. We're going to unpack that prayer. And the structure that we're going to use is the octave, as is discussed in the Gurdjieffian work. And fortunately, I don't know, is Tianjo on?
Yes.
Yeah. These are two individuals who have, we're going to be able to give us a lot of support, I think, in helping us begin it. But we're going to take our time. We're going to exercise our right of what I call slow reading. We're going to go at whatever pace we need to go for all of us to get the beginnings of understanding of this. This was a very exciting chapter for me to face because I was really fighting it. Mm-hmm. I fought tooth and nail against this chapter. And then finally, thanks to a lot to some work with George, it really became clear to me that, no, I need this as well. And then fostered by commentary that Harry and Hawk Lady gave in different contexts, was really able to embrace it. And I want to say that I want to embrace the unknown here. This is the first chapter in a certain way that it's evident that there's material here that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't know, and there's a lot of that material that is very difficult for us. But guess what? That's okay. It's okay that we don't know.
Well, I think it's also, also the position of this chapter in the book is very profound. I mean, because, you know, in a sense, this chapter 11 that we dwelled on for a few weeks is the core of this practice. It's the actual contemplations, you know, the process of prayer absolute. So you might say, you could think of this octaves chapter as being, oh, this is a little anticlimactic, but it's also sort of like gleaning, it's sort of like the harvest, you know, harvesting the results of actually entering into the practice of prayer absolute, or something like that. I was also thinking of what happens when the seventh seal is opened.
Correct.
Then there's a total. Then it isn't like chaos or an explosion or some kind of radiance breaks out. It's like there's total silence in heaven. Everything stops. or something like that. So that it seems to me this is in that position in the book where you've just read through, you've just been presented with the sort of like the obligation or the task. If you should choose to accept this assignment, it's like the most profound practice that you could apply in your life, probably, the prayer absolute, to relieve the suffering of the absolute. And so here's, where do you go to after that?
So the prayer absolute in itself is a potent tool, but we're going to unpack it. We're going to start to unpack it in the next several weeks so we can understand, let's just say, the structure of it, and how we can then bring that structure into the rest of our lives as we go forward. So Ivan, do you want to get us started by just helping us out with the header then?
Okay. Chapter 12, octaves. Got something?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Prayer absolute is in the form of an objective nine-stepped octave, which includes two intentional retardations introduced by internal activities of the awakened biological machine. The passage from one scale to another is what those steeped in scientific superstition call magic.
Okay. So we're going to start, we'll start with just a simple reading of the first few paragraphs, and it's going to start introducing a couple of the most important phrases for us. And then we'll take our time and start to unpack it. And like I say, it's important for us to understand, certainly for me to understand, what to have a sense of what I don't know in this, but also to have a sense of what we need and to explain further. All of us are in this together, okay? That's critical to understand, that all of us bring a specific element to the invocation. When we work together invocationally in as we are in this hour, each person here, there's six of us here in the room, physically here, and a number of us online. And each individual participant at this time, whether you're signed in or not signed in, right, brings an element that's critical to this specific invocation. And as the invocation opens, dare I say, in a proper manner,
okay.
I'm not going to explain that, it will open up a doorway through which we will be able to go and help bring in the information that will be shared with us both, I think, ourselves, but you know, we'll be taking a leadership from George and Pianjo tonight, I hope. So I'm going to go ahead and get started, and let's just see where we wind up, okay? And the first paragraph is potent. We won't get to the actual unpacking of the prayer absolute as was discussed in the previous chapter for probably for a week, maybe even two. All right, it's but we will get to it. We're not going to hurry our way there because we, those of us that are not trained in some of the fourth way material that Gurdjieff has presented for us, we will need to get that basis of understanding, at least the working basis of it, okay? Okay. So during an invocational discourse, that sets the terminology that we're working with here. During an invocational discourse, we may not always be able to introduce an idea at that exact moment that we consider appropriate or necessary. Perhaps the idea even becomes useless as the course of conversation changes. But if we revise our ideas of ordinary conversation in favor of invocational discourse, we will see that the sequence of ideas serves a very different purpose. So what our author here is telling us, he's saying, there's a couple of ways to discuss and look at discourse. One, it can be an exposition of ideas, or it can be notes presented to aid in an invocational event. All right? The particular context of this concert is a discourse. And the discourse is a discourse of an invocational nature. That is what we are looking for here and what we're working with. are once we can get into the beginnings of an invocational discourse, then we are slightly beyond the human realm, and we're beginning to touch briefly on the higher centers. And at that point, we can maybe begin to hear a different form of idea. So invocational discourse. The method is that the sequence of ideas and the words that are shared at moments with intensity, with rhythm, with emphasis, de-emphasis, in such a way that it provides for the invocation to occur. So those that have ears will hear this, and the ears will take a different form than we've noticed we normally use. We must learn to hold an idea through a retardation. So there we have our first term that we want to make note of. So make a note of that. That's a term that we're going to discuss in some detail as we go through this. All I'm doing right now, Silverdale, is laying a groundwork upon which hopefully then we can expose some of the concepts. During which other ideas are being presented, perhaps quite different from our own. This could mean that the whole course of conversation that happens to be proceeding may not be at all to our liking. We may, in the course of ordinary conversation, think of our ideas as important expressions of our inner self. We may. In this way, we serve only ourselves. In the discourse, however, we serve something higher than ourselves, and the purpose of the discourse is invocational. So when we are speaking one to another, are we simply like off and on exchanging ideas? Here's my idea. I'll hear your idea. Oh, here's my idea. Here's your idea. And there's a disconnect there. Or are we working together to create a common invocation through the methodology that we happen to have, which is called discourse? It all happens to be also where we stand within that. So it's invocational, not simply self-expressive. In the discourse, we are no longer competing with one another to present our subjective or even objective ideas. The subject matter and the course of conversation are unimportant in their details and fixations.
We have a question.
Go ahead.
Okay, Simon is saying, is the discourse meant to be the same as recitation of the prayer itself, or something different from the prayer formula?
Yeah. Well, thank you, Susan, and welcome.
Thank you.
The discourse, that's just a concept. What we do with the discourse is different. If what our objective in the discourse is to declare ideas, that's one thing. But if the intent within us of the discourse is to share and create a mutual invocation, then the discourse starts to take on the shape of that prayer absolute, Simon. So it's, where are we in it? That's probably the most important part of it. Ideas in an invocational discourse serve the same purpose as a rudder on a boat. Note, if at least one person in the discourse knows how to steer the conversation and has the sight of the destination, which is not the ordinary destination of personal subjective conversation, perhaps the importance of our own ideas loses its force as we change our fixation from personal conversation in which we feel our own self-importance is at stake, and we feed our desire to make some mark in the world, to have a definite effect on something or someone. And I think that was part of what caught me early on a few weeks ago when I was reading this chapter, is I started to worry. I started to worry about my personal self-importance being at stake. And I thought, I actually went through a trauma personally about, I don't know this stuff. I don't really understand it at all. And then I had, and George participated with Guillermo and Lupe and myself, and he began to discuss the octaves. I felt more ill at ease at that point. I felt more ill at ease. I got further into this trauma of my self-importance being at stake. And that was what helped me get to the next level. It was that pressure. Does this make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
Okay, so I was hit by that pressure of a form of fear. I was on unsteady ground, very much so. I was ready to throw the towel in.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of people helped me through that. So what is the purpose of our discourse? And when we are together as friends, I don't care what the context is, really, Ivan. I don't care if the context is in a class like this or we're going to the local store to get a bag of chips or something. Is our discourse for the sake of self-importance, or is it for continuing the invocation that we have among friends? All right? So this is just an example right now. We're giving an example of how the energetics work in this particular case. You're going to say something?
So, well, it seems to me that the distinction is pretty clear between conversation, just everyday conversation, and what he's calling discourse.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's because we're having a meeting, because we're meeting like this once a week and we're dealing with an invocational text, I think that's different from conversation for us. We've already distinguished this hour from conversation.
From normal conversation. But
yeah.
What I want to state, though, however, is that if we're with our Voyager friends,
mm-hmm.
can we place in there the idea of that this is an invocational event as well? And I think the answer is yes, you can. And I know you can. And I'm thankful to many people for that. Okay, we're getting close. With the change of fixation from conversation to discourse, we can easily hold an idea until the moment when it is really appropriate. In the invocational sense, we hold the idea when it's appropriate in the invocational sense, not in the sense of personal urgency. To introduce it, we hold it, which is to say, when the course of the dialogue has run completely, but temporarily out of force. All right? Now, one must learn to hold the idea, introduce it only when it becomes necessary. And here the term becomes necessary takes on the principle of necessary to either help sustain the invocation or to aid the invocation to go to a different level. And this is the area I think it's absolutely thrilling to understand a little bit more about the octaves, all right?
Mm-hmm.
To let it go to another level. If the shock is introduced too soon, and now this is another technical term, so that we have retardation, We have shock, right?
Right.
Now we have shock. Is introduced too soon, it can easily produce a fragmentation of the continuing flow of the discourse. Those of you who have worked together in invocational spaces and have a good sense of that know when a malaprop has occurred, when something just was off. But, and if you're attuned to the invocational aspect of it, you can sense it immediately. So, there you go. If this, so if the shock is introduced too soon, and it creates this fragmentation of the flow of discourse. Naturally, in the course of ordinary self-expressive conversation, we do not really care if the flow is destroyed, because we're not interested in the invocation, right? We're just, we're interested in just the conversation, a good chat with a good buddy, which often means they let me talk. our only concern is somehow to cram our ideas down the throats. Now, a discourse can be looked at in terms of geometry. Geometrically, the division of a discourse is similar to that of a musical octave. Which is to say a single sound divided by fragmentation into several definite unequal parts. In the same way that light is colorless, is a colorless single thing divided first into whiteness and then into separate colors. Each of it represents smaller and smaller fragmentations or notes of color descending into secondary, tertiary, quaternary, stages of cellular division. Now, sound and color are not the only things which descend by fragmentation from a single larger thing. In the same category, we will discover many manifestations of nature, such as that which produces separate objects, thoughts, and emotions. Even the subtle qualities of wine are produced in such a way. Now, when I read that, George, it made me, because I did do some reading after our conversation. I did some reading on the law of seven, the octave concepts in the Gurdjieffian work, and that reminded me like of the ray of creation, that paragraph, that particular paragraph. Is it time to introduce that idea yet, or floundering array here, so you or Harry want to pipe in, it would be very helpful.
Well, we've got a comment here.
Comment away, Susan.
So Piandra says that conversation exchanges information. Discourse has the intent to serve.
So the conversation, I didn't get all of that, Susan. Do you want to take another shot at it?
Sure. Conversation exchanges information. Discourse has the intent to serve.
Okay.
And another comment from Simon. What is an example of retardation and a shock in this context?
Yeah, David, maybe I can help you out on that one.
Please.
You know, Gurdjieff indicated that the purpose of all schools and religions and philosophies and ethics and so on is to explain how unity passes into multiplicity and diversity. That's really only half the problem. The other half of the problem, which we're attempting to deal with here, is how do we put multiplicity and diversity back into unity. So if we take the moment of our conception by way of example, we can see the division, multiplication, diversification of the physical body, later of our thoughts and our emotions. So Gurdjieff's in order to try to explain to people how unity passes into multiplicity and diversity, and how multiplicity and diversity can be reunified into unity for ourselves personally as well as throughout the universe, he introduced the idea of the octaves, which is what we've just read here, how a single note can be fragmented into multiple tones, or the white light can be fragmented into multiple colors. And, of course, by the time you get down to the our level, there's just so much multiplicity and diversity, we just can hardly juggle it. And what this chapter is attempting to do is help us reclimb that ladder back toward unity. And by the way, in answer to Simon's question, what is an example of retardation and a shock? What Gurdjieff indicates is that there are two intervals in a octave. So if you think of about a piano keyboard, C, D, E, and then there's no black note there between E and F, and then G, A, B, and then again no black half note between B and the subsequent C of the next higher octave. And so that those two intervals are important. It's one of the mechanisms the Absolute used in order to set our creation into motion, and in order to bridge the gap of those intervals, an outside force is required. So we call that sometimes a shock, synonymous with that is an outside force of some kind is necessary to fill that those two intervals. It's also the octave is sometimes referred to do, re, mi, an interval, fa, sol, la, si, an interval, and then the do of the next octave. So anyway, that's a beginning point.
So, I think it's actually important to begin to get a sense of that, of what George is telling us there, that structure and how it works. Now, that maybe I'll try to restate it, okay? And that from, and I'd really appreciate feedback. I'm just going to use my own terminology. That a process begins, and that it goes through a number of steps. And at a certain point, energetically, there's a, like an energetic pause in a certain way. And if nothing happens at that point but the regular stuff, if nothing happens, then there's a declination of that energy. And as if it continues with nothing happening, it'll decline yet again and again and again until the cycle becomes exactly, you basically wind up where you started. Part of the key, and this is what I'm hoping to see if we can learn in the next few weeks, is can we recognize that first, is it mi fa?
Yes.
Mi fa.
The mi fa interval.
Is it, can we, in our, maybe in our everyday life, can we, or at least in the context of this, begin to recognize that point and then investigate the idea, how then can you inject an intentional shock? Question.
Well, can I say something?
Yeah.
I really appreciated the point that Pianjo, that Harry dwelt on in what he wrote on the website, which is to say that this, let's say, one way of talking about this, or one aspect of this, is using the example of discourse rather than conversation. There's this idea, well, I think I can summarize
yes.
it more. There's this idea that you need to hold, that we need to hold an idea that, let's say, it's sort of like, my interpretation of it is like you're just sort of mindlessly or just socially bubbling up with whatever your opinions and ideas are and so on and talking to people. You wouldn't dream of deliberately holding a comment or an idea or an insight that you have, because as soon as you have it, you want to push it out, you want to pour it out and get people's response and have them react to it and think how great you are because you had this idea and so on, and you make it this comment. But I think what Harry was pointing out is that it's sort of like this idea of the do re mi. It's, if it's an energetic process, right, that you're saying
yes.
is being described. So there's sort of like there's, if you're having a certain degree of awareness or sensitivity to a discourse rather than just kind of bubbling along conversation, that you could actually stop yourself from blurting something out, or you know, thinking you have some insight that you listen to what the discourse is, or pay attention to the entire, you know, what are you sensing about the space, and so on, and that you would hold on to that. And what this text seems to be saying is that there's a point where it feels like, when it feels like the energy is declining, you know, when there's an entropic effect, then there's an appropriate time to bring out a new insight or idea, because that is a shock or a retardation. See, I don't quite get what the, you know, I can see why it's called a retardation in the musical analogy. I have a little trouble translating from a shock or a, you know, putting something in that's an energy push. Calling that a retardation just seems like an oddity in English. It might
no,
be different
I think
in
that
other languages.
George, help me out here, but I think that there occurs a retardation,
well,
and
it will
continue to occur
yeah.
unless there is a shock.
Well, that's not my understanding. Is see do re mi fa, like George said, on the white keys on the piano.
Yeah.
There's a whole step, whole step, whole step. Do re mi. Fa is a half step, which that to me it's a retardation, because instead of a whole step, you're only taking a half step.
Correct.
But okay, but then the theory behind that, say musically, and then in the octave, in the fourth way theory, there's that retardation is an indication of an impingement, where energetically there's an impingement from a different octave, which you could say, you know, in terms of music,
make-
it's like instead of the C major octave, where you go with the half step, that maybe that's the F, you know, there's an F, an E, or an F, or some other octave, a whole other octave that sounds different, but that's impinging there, that makes that effect energetically. But it's not, doesn't retardation refer to a musical effect also, or not? You don't think so?
Dan is saying that he thinks that the musical analogy falls apart at that point.
Anyway, could I just go
yeah.
back to what Harry was saying? That I just wanted to finish the idea that there was another part of it that Harry picked up on, which is sort of, it does come in here as far as we've read, but it's more prominent, I think, later in this chapter, that waiting is involved, is that sometimes you simply have to wait, that actually to upscale, to bring in this other influence and go from the everyday mechanical sort of repetition, octave, to go into another octave, which means changing scale or invoking, let's say, you know, being invocational about the process that you're doing, whatever process that is, that it requires waiting, and that it's like instead of being, that's what it has to do with more self-awareness rather than being so mechanical and jumping and doing what we always do. Jumping in.
The point being that you hold a different viewpoint, which is invocational rather than mm-hmm. discourse. So George, can you help us out here? Like what Ivan was saying, that is, when I think of it, it seems like there's a vibrational, that the vibrations are increasing, and then there's literally a retardation that it's increasing at a different rate, and then that is the retardation.
The half step, isn't that the half step?
That's what I'm asking. That's where the retardation is, Dan said.
Well, and you know, look at you know this rapidly gets somewhat more involved. we start off with something we say is very simple, an octave with a couple of intervals in it. But what Gurdjieff actually does, what Gurdjieff's intent is to try to explain two primordial laws upon which the whole universe is constructed, the law of three and the law of seven. So in Prayer Absolute, as this chapter will, and in order to show the relationship between that law of seven and the law of three, Gurdjieff created the Enneagram. So now in the Enneagram we see, and again, you know, this gets maybe more complicated than we want to get into tonight, but the law of seven is organic life. Our physical body and our historical personality operates in accordance with the law of seven, which means we are destined to always go in circles and never be able to make progress forward.
Let's reemphasize that point.
I think that's what Harry was referring to.
I think that's a critical point that we need to emphasize. Can you just say it again?
Yeah. In order for us to achieve transformational evolution, we must be able to independently deflect and manifest the law of three and the law of seven. So think of playing the piano. With your left hand, you're deflecting it to play chords. With your right hand, you're deflecting it to play a melody. These two together make the whole musical composition.
Okay.
So the law of seven, our organic body, our physical body, and our historical personality is under the law, functions solely under the law of seven and must always turn in circles and can never evolve. The only way that evolution for us personally can occur is when we employ the law of three, at specific intervals. And part of invocational discourse recognizes this dynamic and allows us to move up to a higher octave.
Okay.
So that's very useful, George. I would love to have clarified, is that some of the language that EJ uses in this chapter, is the higher octave then not representing the law of seven, even though it still has the same nine tones or whatever, retardations and so on? Know what I mean? Does the higher octave then represent higher energy, higher vibration?
Yes. You know, really, the objective of trying to move to higher octaves is to increase the force of our presence. So the greater our personal... The law of three applies to our essential self, which we've been studying in Life in the Labyrinth, practical work on self, like human biological machine. So we have this invisible something or other. We call it our essential self, the life force that is animating our physical body. We're trying to awaken and educate our essential self to begin to exercise this law of three, which, and as it does, becomes a more dominant part of who we are. Our presence actually is what is migrating up the octaves, and in that process, able to become the master of our organic self, which is still subject to the law of seven.
Yeah, or let's say, in a certain sense, it's stuck in that lower octave.
That's right.
In other words, the lower octave remains.
Yes. We're
not
going to...
Okay, So if I'm sitting there and I'm taking my dog for a walk and I'm upset because it's not doing what I want it to do.
Right.
Okay. And
sounds reasonable.
Somehow I awaken the machine or however, whatever term we want to use, and the essential self comes to bear at that moment. And suddenly, all of it looks very different. Can you help unpack that a little bit, please, George?
Yeah. Now, again, you know, this gets this causes me to introduce yet another little subtlety of Gurdjieff's ideas, which is this. The law of seven, those two intervals, there are three important things to know. One of those intervals must be intentionally actualized. You have to actually think about what you're doing and intentionally do it. That is when I say you, I'm talking about the essential self must intentionally actualize it.
Okay, so I'm going to underline that, please. Intentionally, intentional act here.
And that fills up one of those two intervals, an intentional act of the individual cosmic unit, the person. The second interval was designed for the ingestion of outside forces. So that would simply be cognizant of the circumstances within which you find yourself and the sensing and the feeling of the forces flowing into you, filling up that interval.
That next interval, right?
Is that the CDO interval?
Well, actually, no. The MIFA interval is the interval for the ingestion of outside forces into the individual.
Okay.
Just being aware of yourself and the environment, but to move into the next higher octave, you must intentionally, the essential self must intentionally digest and assimilate what's happening. So, you know, it's, yes, so.
Okay, so, or in EJ's parlance, well, EJ's contribution there is that interval, that retardation or shock or whatever it's called at that point has to be supplied by the awakened state of the biological machine.
Right.
Yeah. What I'm trying to do is actually answer Simon's early question is, what's an example of these things?
Mm-hmm.
And Simon, are we doing that? Because what I'm hoping to do here is that we can begin to use this sense of the octave as a way of enhancing for us the idea of the prayer absolute, that we can make it pragmatic. On the one hand, just if we say and read the prayer absolute in a certain way, it has an effect on us. And I would say that the effect is probably could be delineated in, if we unpacked it, in the way that George is telling us, because it has certain elements that come at certain times. But also, we want to overlay this on our daily life as we go through it. Can we begin to see these elements as they cycle through, a cycle that we can never get out of unless something different happens? And we've been given two examples of something different happening. One is called the become subject to or aware of higher forces. Is that about right?
In the environment? energies?
Well, the mi-fa.
Mm-hmm.
That if...
Well, the, what was... Well, would you repeat that formulation, George?
Well, it, you know, again, how well we work with this is a function of how developed we are. So when we start in the work, this we're just trying to get a sense of the fact that we're being impinged upon by forces from the outside, which we're attempting to cope with. Over time, as our essential self awakens and develops, part of its inherent and natural ability, the natural and inherent possibilities of presence, is to become much more aware of the subtleties of the circumstances. So you have a much finer, a much more refined sensing apparatus.
Right.
Okay.
There you go. And because you do, you then you're able to begin doing something about it.
That's right. And you're able to nourish your presence, or your presence begins to be able to juggle, you might say, the environment much more adroitly.
It's Simon and
okay, but then I'd just like to repeat this point that...
This is great, by the way.
Yeah, that's very helpful.
Very helpful.
George, yeah. I'd like to repeat this point that Harry was dwelling on, and maybe he can correct me if I don't understand it correctly, but, you know, this idea that this part of the invocational process that George is describing here, the do-re-mi-fa, the mi-fa awakening, let's say the supplying of an element that's from a different scale, or let's say from a different dimension or a different somewhere, something else, to change this law, to get out of the law of seven, it also means there's still the rest of this octave to go through.
Yes.
So I believe that Harry was referring to the characteristic of this process that you don't just kick out of this octave into a different scale or a different octave in the first
retardation.
It's like you have to continue. You still have to go through either as if under the law of seven or riding with the law of seven and so on. You have to go right up to the very last interval where the other kick is needed to actually go into another scale of being or another vibrational level, is my understanding.
Yeah, so Ivan, as you're describing, you know, the importance or the value of prayer absolute is it kind of shows the evolution of a whole process. So when in these first three verses of prayer absolute, in motion, bowing,
right.
What we're doing is we're kind of bringing our three lower centers, our historical personality, the ability to think, feel, and move, kind of into a certain alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the interval where we're ingesting forces from the outside which are informing our own presence about...
When we get to that, it has to do with in actual engagement with the suffering of the absolute, in that process.
But I don't want to pass over.
We don't want to get to that yet.
We're
not actually there yet.
We're not quite there yet. But I want to point out something that George says: when they are in alignment.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a certain level of work that we do, and then something is possible for us.
Yeah, Dave, I'd like to just interrupt quickly and emphasize the importance of that. Our thinking, our feeling, and our moving centers operate at different speeds. And because they operate at different speeds, they are quite often they often create dissonance within themselves and between each other. What we're trying to do is bring these three lower centers, thinking, feeling, moving, into a certain degree of equilibrium. Once we are successful in doing that, just practical work on self, then once we succeed in that, then automatically our presence is activated. And
right.
Then we're in the interval of ingesting outside things because we're not so busy dealing with the disharmony and the fragmentation within ourselves, our lower centers.
Okay, so this is a culmination of about 3 years of study that we've been doing, four
mm-hmm.
or 5 years. I don't know how long we've been doing this, but for all from the practical work on self, human biological machine, then, it's bringing those into some form of harmony so that they're working together. And then this term comes up automatically, the presence can come to bear. And in
right.
part because the machine's chatter
right.
is diminished at that time.
Yep.
And when the machine's chatter is diminished, then there is the so-called awakening. It's odd terminology, but actually the machine is quieted.
That's right, yeah. That's in this formulation.
Terminology, yeah.
Yeah, and also it's a kind of an odd representation, but we're also, in this language about the octave, we're calling that a retardation also.
Well, at that point.
A certain shock.
At that point, either you're going to avail yourself of that form of surrender right then and see more around you,
mm-hmm.
or you're going to reassert the machine and you begin going...
That's good. That's what I was having, the same thought, which is like, let's say, in terms of study circle work, probably most everybody here has had this experience where if you're having a discussion and you're discussing ideas, it can fail to become a discourse. It's like it falls into some kind of conversation.
Or debate.
And you see it all the time on websites or Facebook or something like that. You see where somebody's actually trying to delve into something and have an invocational process happen, and it's extremely common for it to devolve instead into a personality conflict, a misunderstanding, name-calling, or the point where somebody's banned from the website.
and Ivan...
and I would call that going back to dough again, yeah.
Ivan, I might just remind us, what all of us participating here tonight are attempting to do is acquire something called personal presence. And
right.
as we acquire personal presence, we become more or less a more unified entity. And so invocational discourse is attempting to allow our presence to carry on a conversation and not our lower centers.
Ego.
Yeah.
Yeah, well put.
Right, and also, I think you're, also, George, I think that dovetails with the idea that we're also evolving over time, we might say, or...
Yeah.
Whatever you call this process here of meeting every week, a group presence also, because EJ makes reference in this chapter to this idea of the crystal radio, you know, where as a group we become, if we reach this point that you're talking about where we're all speaking or we're all vibrating more as essential selves or as essential presences, then we have the possibility of becoming parts of this angel or higher order being, where he describes it a very interesting way, that we become like the internal organs of that vibrational entity, where each essential self, let's say, because each of us, I believe EJ is saying that even as an essential self, each of us has certain archetypal characteristics, which we then carry
yes.
into as a to the to become the part of this mechanism, or what would you call it, this entity, which is a higher vibrational entity. We've
yep.
actually invoked an entity onto our group, let's say.
Yeah.
And so that's getting a little ahead in the chapter also.
It is a bit, but if we just stay with this very first part of the idea of the bringing the three parts of the lower to a sense of harmony such that then the presence can be
automatically activated.
Activated.
So it's beginning to become activated. So that's the case then in our, we're going to take a couple of different views of it, but all of us as individuals have put in the effort to activate that and to modify the, to bring those three parts into being. Therefore, all of our presence, in a sense, are part of a presence that is in this invocation.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Yeah, or that's what every week that we do this, with the potential is here for this to happen.
And we should note, though it's very difficult to recall, note the difference between now. Susan came in right at the very, very end of HBM. Simon has been here from practical work on self all the way through, as of course George has. So this is a lot of time in grade.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So in a certain way, it's a teeny bit easier for us to get to that first point where there's the automatic activation of the essential self as a group as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we help each other in that, because we're reminded in our presence of each other's presence helps us. I look around here and I'm put on pause in my machine with the, when I look around, and I don't just see individuals, I see these depths of essential self around me, and I'm quite moved by it. And so that does something for me. It allows me to go to that next few steps there. Oddly enough, Ivan, we've come to the end of a full hour. This is the fastest one
really,
hour that
well,
I recall.
Like those guys on public radio, they say, well, you've wasted another good hour with Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers.
No, we haven't wasted it, because I think that we were able, and with great thanks to what Harry posted on the site and the specific guidance tonight from, in such a generous way, from Silverdale, help us get through the beginnings of what the heck is an octave. So with those elements in place, I'll try to load the audio part up on the website. I'll see if I can do it tonight. I know I'm going to need to listen to it again and get some of this data, but this was invaluable.
Yeah, this is good. I'm going to be. This is really a really worthwhile, I think, to dwell on this chapter. I'm going to be happy to go through
it. Doesn't matter to me if it takes us 4 or 5 weeks, because it's, even if we continue to recycle through it until all of us have a little bit of an ability to eat this meal together and digest it well. So we're going to call it the end of this particular part of chapter 12. And I'm glad you got back, George, and thank you so much for the help tonight.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for leading us, David. We need a fearless leader out front.
Okay. I'll try to bring the fearless part next time, okay? Okay, so thank you, everybody,
thanks.
And we'll look forward to seeing you on next Wednesday. Good night.
Okay. Good night, all.